Next is Candace Muschello versus Hackensack Meridian. Council could please step forward. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Christina Badgley Harvey from the Mira Law as the appointment counsel for the appellant.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Russell Malt with the Lasky Movie Chef, Conlin et al., appearing on behalf of the defendant.
Good afternoon, Catherine Flynn with Flynn Watts, for the NAPA, the Lucas American Medical Association, and the Society of New Jersey.
Welcome, counsel. Ms. Basilou Harvey.
Thank you, Your Honors. May I request time for rebuttal?
Of course.
Thank you. Before the court is whether plaintiff's affidavit of merit was sufficient, and if it was not sufficient, then whether she satisfied the exceptional circumstances and or substantial compliance doctrines. We believe that the affidavit of merit in this case was sufficient under our statute. And in order to resolve that question, the court has to look at the plain language of the statute. There's two issues that defendants have raised that are not a part of the plain language. And the plaintiff is asking this court to reject adding in those conditions that don't exist. The first of which is whether or not you have to identify the defendant's conduct and name him by name or her by name. The statute states that in relevant part, under 2A53A-27, provide each defendant with an affidavit of an appropriate licensed person that there exists a reasonable probability that the care, skill, or knowledge exercised or exhibited in the treatment, practice, or work that is the subject of the complaint fell outside acceptable professional or occupational standards or treatment practices. It doesn't say defendant's care. It doesn't qualify, and defendants are asking you to add that requirement in. And the reason that that's so problematic in professional malpractice cases is that at the beginning of the case, you might not know all the facts, and you allege anyone you think might be liable, and you ask your expert to review, is there enough to go forward? And we provide a good faith basis. It's a threshold. This court, in one of the very first decisions under the affidavit of merit statute, the In Re Hall case, 147 NJ at page 391, 1997, talked about what this threshold means. And the court said the threshold is summary in nature. It is not an expert report. You can have an expert report at that stage. And I'll give you a hypothetical as to why it's so important that we reject the trial court's commentary that the affidavit of merit is not a multiple choice exam. It actually is, because you're giving everyone on notice of that this could go forward. So let's suppose we have a surgery and it's very simple negligence that in the placement of the plaintiff while she's under the placement leads to drop foot. You know who's in that operating room. You don't know, though, as the plaintiff, especially at the very beginning, before there's been any deposition, before you've read any interrogatories, who actually placed the plaintiff. It might be in the records, but it might not be. And you need to be able to allege that any of those parties were negligent. And that's why the legislature resolved that, because they didn't say, well, you have to actually say it was defendant's care, skill, or knowledge exercised. It's just the care, skill, or knowledge exercised or exhibited in the treatment, practice, or work, that is the subject of the complaint. And here, if we look at the subject of our complaint, paragraph 10, it goes into the fact that we don't really know who the identity of the employees are, but it's those hospital employees of Jersey Shore Medical Center who failed to test the glucose levels once plaintiff was unconscious and non-responsive. And defendant had made a comment about how she had earlier refused treatment. First off, while a medical record might state that, that's not the be-all and end-all of what actually happens. As we know, medical records are a hearsay document. That's defendant's version of what happened. And defendant, which leads into point two of the add-ins that defendant wants to add in that a plaintiff must have the expert review the medical records and state that they reviewed them. But the medical record might be completely wrong. We have cases that we've seen where the doctor doctors the medical records. They go through and edit them. And you're not going to know that at the
Nobody's
point.
Nobody's claiming that happened.
Not here, but it happens. And that's why we can't add a requirement that says you have to rely upon something that's defendant's own creation. When here, plaintiff has certified multiple times in both her oppositions and in court that she was there the last 6 hours of her daughter's life. She knows that they didn't test the blood sugars that they should have been testing.
Is it sufficient to rely solely on the basis of the assertions in a complaint?
I believe under the statute, it is sufficient to just rely upon that. And here, Mr. Malta says, well, you could have someone gaming the system, but that can happen anytime. And here in this particular case, you don't have that because she's certified under oath. She's certified under penalty of perjury. This is what happened. And also in the record, PA 122, the trial court acknowledges that Dr. Fallon did have the medical records. Dr. Fallon might not have put in that he reviewed them, but that's not what is stated in the statute. Nowhere in what I read says that you have to say what was actually reviewed in order to come up with this threshold decision.
Sorry, so it sounded like you were arguing that the person who's writing the affidavit of merit doesn't have to review the medical records, but now it sounds like you're shifting to say they just don't have to explicitly state that they reviewed them. Here it's acknowledged, or at least plaintiff says, that he did review the medical records. He just didn't write in the AOM, and I reviewed the medical records, correct?
Factually, that's this case, that he did review them, but he didn't say he reviewed them. However, what I'm arguing in terms of interpreting the law, that this court, because it comes up in so many cases, so I'm urging this court that you should expressly state that you do not need to review the medical records. You can have-
What would be the point of that in terms of having an affidavit of merit that addresses the actual issues in the case? I mean, how could a doctor be able to opine as to whether or not there was professional negligence, even at an AOM stage, short of an expert report, if the doctor doesn't take the time to review the medical records?
From plaintiff's version of what's said, either in the complaint, there's really four factual categories that the expert can look at and come to the conclusion that there's a good faith basis to go forward. And each case is factually.
If a plaintiff says, I went to the hospital and I got sicker and they're negligent, the doctor can just say, in my professional opinion, that they're negligent?
Well, he has to have a basis for why they're negligent.
And in order to have a basis, wouldn't the doctor have to review those records?
I don't think so, because the records are not necessarily accurate. There's also...
That's not necessary to decide this case. Correct. You're asking the court to say that for guidance going forward, but it's not necessary to decide this case, because in this case, on the factual record, he did review it. He just didn't write in the AOM, and I reviewed the medical records.
Correct.
And you also have a fairly detailed complaint.
I do.
Why don't you tell us the four categories, the four factual categories?
The first would be the complaint itself could provide a basis for the expert to provide a theory that there's enough to go forward. So in this case, the expert was given a very detailed basis that she's unresponsive. She had complaints earlier in the day of hyperglycemic symptoms, and that then the medical report that came out showed that they never tested for the glucose, but they did test for opiates, and there's no opiates in her system. So under the facts, it showed that what the doctors had thought happened didn't actually happen. And I think that allegation is enough to go forward. And the autopsy is actually not part of the medical records. That's another thing that they could review. But in terms of the four categories, we first have our complaint. Second, we have that the expert can interview the plaintiff. And that happens all the time in cases. And I would, because the AOM applies to all different types of cases. So in my legal malpractice cases, my legal mal expert talks to the plaintiff to find out what happened, to flesh out whether or not there's malpractice. And that interview is very important to finding out if there's enough to go forward. So that's the second category. The third category is obviously the medical records, which we all agree would be relevant. And then the fourth category is the uniform interrogatories. So the AOM is due at day 60 from the answer. Under rule 4:17-1B2, what's also due at day 60 is the answer to the uniform interrogatories. And in a medical malpractice case, form C3 number 7 specifically says, attach a copy of any written records or documents that you have regarding plaintiff, along with type transcription of any handwritten records or documents. So plaintiff by day 60 should have had these answers. And under the oral argument on the motion to dismiss, plaintiff says, it's impossible for me to get the AOM without the medical records. And the trial court says, well, your notice to produce is too late. But that's not true, because your notice to produce was actually irrelevant. There was a factual basis to find under 2A53A-28 for a waiver, because more than 45 days had passed from when defendant, by court rule, was required to give the medical records. Now, Section 28 is not limited to just medical records either. It says, fail to provide plaintiff with medical records or other records or information having a substantial bearing on preparation of the affidavit. So all of these answers to interrogatories are very relevant to providing that information. Under number 3, it talks about the dates and circumstances under which you saw plaintiff, all examinations, the results of those examinations, the prognosis, the treatment. And let's not forget, plaintiffs have a constitutional right to the trial by jury. And that has been limited by the AOM statute, but only by the terms of that statute. So we can't go adding in extra requirements. Both parties have to act fairly. We have to give an AOM, but at the same time, defendant can't withhold this information so that we can't comply. That's the point of Section 28. And I understand Mrs. Michella was pro se, so some of this was not properly fleshed out. But under the order that was in effect for the relevant time period, it talks about in recognition of the pervasive and severe effects of the COVID-19 public health crisis, the court in any individual matter consistent with rule 1:1-2A may suspend proceedings, extend discovery or other deadlines, or otherwise accommodate the legitimate needs of the parties, attorneys, and others in the interest of justice. It also specifically with regard to the AOM says, although it said the general extension of deadlines for filing affidavits of merit and medical and professional malpractice cases will conclude as of July 26, 2020, just 4 days after this complaint's filed, extensions may be provided in individual cases.
Everybody agreed that the affidavit of merit that was submitted, it's in dispute here, was submitted on the day it was due. There was an extension given to December 23rd. She gave it to the defendant on December 23rd. So that extension issue isn't an issue, is it?
I think it goes to whether or not if this court rejects the sufficiency of the AOM, then it is relevant. But if this AOM was sufficient, just it was timely.
Isn't one of your arguments that all this dispute about what was in, what wasn't in, what needed to be in, what should have been in, the affidavit of merit should have been resolved by the court conducting a Ferrara conference, which it never conducted?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And aren't you relying on that more than this issue of extensions or whatever? If there was a deficiency on December 23rd, all the court had to do was say, let's have that conference, that case management conference, to figure out what the dispute is so that we can resolve it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Under the case.
Where?
In AT versus Cohen, it talked about how at 231 NJ 347, that there it was an issue with the automatic failure. And this court said that that constituted exceptional circumstances. So this case, though, I think that this case shows extraordinary circumstances even more than AT versus Cohen, because in this case, the trial court made a conscious decision to adjourn that 4-hour conference, saying that the conference shouldn't be held because the affidavit was not submitted. But this court was very clear in Ferrara itself and then other cases that came after that there's a twofold purpose to the affidavit of merit requirement. One, was it submitted? It's a reminder. And two, is it sufficient? So here, as the reminder.
But you're saying it's twofold purpose of Ferrara.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
Yes.
In terms of your argument that the person who is alleged to have acted negligently does not have to individually be named as a defendant, that specifically applies in cases of respondeat superior liability, where you're trying to hold an entity liable for the conduct of its employees. You might not know which employee specifically was negligent. Here, though, in the AOM, he does say Dr. Vikas Singh, now known to be Dr. Vikas Singh, comma, the physician in charge of the efforts to resuscitate decedent. So he does label the specific employee of defendant who he alleges behaved negligently. It's just that Dr. Vikas Singh had not been added as an individual defendant, correct?
Yes, to that point, but it's twofold. Yes, that Dr. Singh doesn't have to be a defendant at all.
Correct. He never has to be an individual defendant. Right. You can just hold the hospital liable for his conduct, correct?
Yes. And because Dr. Singh was an employee, then there's at least one defendant that we have alleged in the AOM that this case should be kept alive.
That's because the defendant was the entity, Hackensack Meridian Jersey Shore University Medical Center.
Correct. But the second part of that is that the complaint under paragraph 10 alleges negligence by the employees. And Dr. Fallon's affidavit talks also about exhibited by one or more of the defendants therein, including Dr. Singh, one of the John and Jane Doe defendants sued therein. So he's talking about in reviewing that the two pages that he had and in reviewing the complaint that somebody breached the standard of care. And that's all the statute required. So we should have been able to go forward against the hospital, figure out who these negligent parties were through discovery, and go forward. And I also think that it was error for the trial court to say that we didn't actually have Dr. Singh name, that it was a multiple choice. It wasn't a multiple choice because including is inclusive. It has to require it. So
how does the judge in a Ferrara conference or in a motion make a determination as to whether the author of the affiant in the AOM has the right specialty if there's no definition anywhere of who it is that's supposed to have been, you know, what human being is supposed to have been negligent as opposed to an entity?
So in this case, it's a entity is the only remaining defendant as of that conference. So, or there was no conference, but as of the time of the motion, the only entity is left is the hospital.
Right.
And you prove the hospital, if you look at Haviland, you prove it based upon any professional who has experience with that.
Haviland dealt with a situation where the alleged negligence was by a non-professional.
Yes.
If you, here, it certainly appears from the nature of the allegations is there is negligence, professional negligence is the predicate of the respondeat superior theory that the plaintiff pursued, correct?
Correct.
So in that case, it's Haviland doesn't answer that question. In that case, at some point, the judge has to make a determination if there's a challenge to an AOM based upon what is the correct medical specialty or subspecialty. Who in the vast hospital here is alleged to have been negligent, and what is the nature of the negligence? You see what I'm saying?
I do, Your Honor.
And so if we were to say, well, don't even worry about it. If they're suing the hospital, don't worry about identifying for the court or anybody else or for the defendant, what person's supposed to have done this? You know, often you see in a John Doe, neurologists, radiologists, et cetera, the specialties are there. But if we were to say, don't worry about it, if they sue the hospital, it just really doesn't matter. How can the court adjudicate a challenge to the specialty or subspecialty of the affiant who prepared the AOM?
So in this case, you would look at first, that's Dr. Singh. And Dr. Singh, as of the date of the malpractice, which the record is actually wrong on this, but if you look at there's a public record. You can check. As long as they're licensed in New Jersey, you can check when they receive their board certification. And in this case, Dr. Singh was only a resident at the time, was not entitled to any special under Section 41. He's basically a generalist. So in that circumstance, Dr. Fallon, whose CV was included, was able to give the affidavit of merit. For other persons who are yet identified, then it would be that you can go forward, and then if they are entitled to more than what the hospital is entitled to under Section 41, because the care deals with that and discovery reveals they have that, then you would have to deal with it later. I don't think
how? A new affidavit of merit?
Depending. So under Gonzalez versus Ibrahim, that's unreported, so I don't know if it has the site yet, but it came out in February. It's cited in my supplemental brief. It was in the appellate division. I believe they've actually sought certification from this court. But in that case, that was something that is similar. So there, the plaintiff files a motion saying common knowledge applies, and the court agrees and enters an order. But then there's an amendment adding in a new defendant who asks for the AOM, and the court doesn't hold the Ferrara conference. Plaintiff's response is that, well, we have an order, and that order entailed your conduct as well. And so the court found that there was exceptional circumstances to give more time, and plaintiff did comply after they had a conference to get the AOM, but it was outside of that window.
But you would you say that at some point in this process there is an AOM requirement that's relevant to, or there has to be an AOM that deals with the specialty or subspecialty of the physician, nurse, dentist, whomever, who's alleged to have been negligent and who is alleged to put the hospital on the hook? See what I'm saying?
I do. But in terms of, you're only entitled to the same credentialing when it falls under Section 41. So only a doctor really who's board certified is going to have that special requirement. Otherwise, right, anyone with experience, it would be sufficient.
Right.
So here,
but all I'm saying is you don't know that if you don't identify anybody, and you don't, and at the stage of the case where the AOM is being prepared and where there's potentially a Ferrara conference, the defendant's really not in a position to have that, to make that objection, or to at least have it decided upon. And shouldn't there be a requirement at some point that there has to be an AOM that fits what turns out to be the relevant field, if it is a Section 41 case?
So I think that what there is, a defendant knows, because we, in terms of the complaint, as long as the complaint sufficiently alleges, like in this case, defendant knows who those entities or those professionals were who treated plaintiff during those last, at the code blue.
You've got a lot of experience.
They know who.
You've got a lot of experience. Knowing who the universe of treaters, especially if somebody's hospitalized, obviously this is not a long hospitalization, but you could have somebody in the hospital for a month, and there could be literally hundreds of people who are treaters. So to say defendant knows who they are, when you have a complaint that simply says there's been negligence and that therefore the hospital is on the hook, I would respectfully suggest doesn't answer the question.
So, but what I'm suggesting is...
You don't have to get there for this case at all, because the AON does identify Dr. Singh, correct?
Correct.
And also, if I thought at one point defendant was alleging that Dr. Singh was Bird certified in internal medicine, you seem to be saying that he wasn't. But even if he was, would not be any issue with a lack of matchup, because Dr. Fallon too was Bird certified in internal medicine, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. Dr. Singh currently is Bird certified in internal medicine, but as of the date of negligence, he was not.
But regardless, had he been at the date of negligence, Dr. Fallon clearly says that he's board certified in internal medicine. Yes. And so even if Dr. Singh also was, perfect, that's a match.
Yes.
And were Fallon's credentials disputed with respect to the affidavit of merit?
I will defer to defendant, because I was not counsel below. I believe in the record, there seemed to be some suggestion, but then it seemed to that they then relented to say it was. So if I'm misstating that, I will let defendant correct it. But I believe that initially there was a brief submitted by defendant to say that it was not appropriate, but I think that they then corrected it because it is appropriate. He is internal medicine, and so is Dr. Singh.
Let's assume they contested that, and it was always contested. Is there any reason you can imagine, or that you expect them to argue, that it's not the court's responsibility, based on the precedent of this court, to have a Ferreira conference and flesh exactly that out, what the qualifications are, whether they're suitable, adequate, whether there is in fact an averment of negligence against somebody with similar credentials? Aren't those exactly the things that happen at a Ferreira conference and requires that they be held? And that's the court's responsibility. And that didn't happen.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. That's the whole purpose of the Ferreira conference.
Can I ask you, do you have any knowledge if there's a dispute as to whether or not a Ferreira conference occurred in this case?
So the record shows that the conference was adjourned by the court. The court talks about it at oral argument, and I believe she talks about...
She says it was canceled because there was no affidavit of merit.
Correct, Your Honor.
That's the judge.
Yes.
So the parties agree, as far as you're concerned, that there was no conference.
Correct. So in terms of the remaining argument, that substantial compliance, and I'm going to merge exceptional circumstances, because step five of substantial compliance really is extraordinary circumstances. But both of those doctrines are equitable in nature, and both of them require the totality of the circumstances.
We'd only have to get to either if we found that AOM was not sufficient, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. I know the medical association has taken the position that we should basically get rid of exceptional circumstances, and I don't think that the court should do that. For the substantial compliance doctrine, this plaintiff did try to comply. She had four attempts to try to comply. The hospital had notice of her claim, her certification provided, exactly what she thought went wrong. Dr. Fallon provided the AOM that we believe is sufficient, and the complaint itself was very detailed. There's general compliance.
Are you raising anything about the court's decision not to grant the plaintiff leave to appeal, or leave to amend the complaint to name Dr. Singh individually?
Yes, Your Honor.
You are raising that issue?
Yeah, I don't, because I wasn't involved at the certification stage and the question did not include it, but it was raised on appeal. And I believe that was an error by the trial court, that leave to appeal should be granted freely in the interest of justice under the Van Natta case, 277 NJS 187, and that here there was a sufficient basis to permit the tolling, that she did not have Dr. Singh's name, and then she was trying to figure out the process, and there was confusion as to how she can comply with the statute. So I believe that there was a sufficient basis for the interest of justice to permit amendment. She did raise John Doe's and had once acted timely once she was alerted to Dr. Singh's involvement.
So if you prevail, you're asking, as part of the court's ruling, to vacate the dismissal with prejudice, allow leave to amend.
Correct, Your Honor.
Please.
Same question.
I think just basically the exceptional circumstances that we alleged here, and I think there are a multitude under our prior cases, for instance, in Peachtree 202, NJ 415, it was just confusion over the lack of the Ferrara conference that this court found entitled the relief under exceptional circumstances. And here it was not only confusion about the AOM, it was confusion on how to comply. And if we had the Ferrara conference, which this court says is a backstop, then it wouldn't have happened. We would have avoided all of this if there was just a conference and an explanation. The court went out of its way to say, well, the staff that you talk to aren't able to really give you that information as to what's required. So how was this pro se to comply? The law library, and defendant discounts the role of a law librarian in this instance, they can help navigate, which this court is well aware that the universe of AOM cases is exponential. So the fact that she didn't have the resource of a law librarian to help her go through that, or the resources of the court to say, oh, it has to be certified. Oh, you need to make sure it's the like credentials person. That shows exceptional circumstances. There are also circumstances going on with COVID and homeschooling her six children, the death of her mother, the death of her mother-in-law, her own depression, which actually in paragraph 11 of the complaint is part of her relief, that there was emotional distress that from her observing the coding of her daughter and the inability of the professionals to help. So I think here there was a sufficient basis, and I will rely on my brief for the itemization of all of those circumstances to justify exceptional circumstances to reinstate the complaint.
And you're relying as well on the delay in receiving papers from the surrogate's office?
Correct. So that delay was twofold, that the spouse of the decedent had to give consent, as well as the estranged father of decedent had to give consent. And there was delay because the estranged father didn't want to renounce his rights, and plaintiff didn't even know where he resided in order to track him down and serve him with papers. And all this is going on during the pandemic. She did apply in July of 2020 for those papers. And I believe that constitutes exceptional circumstances under the totality of this particular case.
Other questions? No. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Malta.
May it please the court. Our position is that the one thing that this court must do in deciding this case is to make explicit what has been implicit in the Affidavit of Merit statute since its very enactment. We submit that a plaintiff's expert, affiant, must review pertinent records, documents, or some original factual material before signing on to an Affidavit of Merit. The plaintiff has to demonstrate that there's such a review and what the review consisted of upon demand or challenge by the defendant. And there's three reasons we would submit for this. Number one is common sense. How in the world can anyone, any expert, swear under oath that a reasonable basis exists to determine that a negligent act occurred if they don't know what happened? They need a source of knowledge for that. I mean, that just makes perfect sense. It's always been presumed that in order to have an expert affiant sign an affidavit of merit in good faith, that they review the pertinent documents. And we're not saying, every single document from birth until the end of the malpractice and beyond. We're saying those documents that are relevant to the claim that's being made against the particular defendant or defendants. Secondly,
we make an analogy to the requirement that the plaintiff produce evidence that it's his or her expert has the requisite qualifications under Section 41. That's a statute, and there's nowhere in the Affidavit of Merit statute, including 41, which says that the plaintiff is required to set forth the qualifications of the expert. And yet this court has mandated that. So this is not an unusual or new concept that there are certain essential things lying behind the Affidavit of Merit that this court has required. Number one, there's that. Number two, this court has engrafted onto the statute the requirement that defendants in their answer specify their area of specialty and their credentialing and qualifications. That's nowhere in the statute. And yet this court had no trouble mandating in Buck versus Henry that be done. Furthermore, the Ferreira Conference. The Ferreira Conference was a concept created by this court. Is nowhere in the Affidavit of Merit statute that says that the court must monitor and assist plaintiffs' attorneys in complying with the clear mandates of the law. And yet this court has done so. So it's nothing alien, unusual, or freakish for this court to make explicit what pretty much 99%+ of litigants understand, and that is that before their expert provides an affidavit of merit, they review records. So we submit that's a clear requirement. And finally, if you read the Affidavit of Merit statute in pari materia with subsection 28, that's the subsection that permits the plaintiff, if they're unable to obtain important and relevant and material documents or other factual information, they can sign an affidavit to that effect and use that as a substitute in lieu of an affidavit of merit from the required expert. That subsection would be completely unnecessary if no review of any factual material was required on the part of the affiant. Now, in this case, there's been a central issue raised by the plaintiff concerning the fact that the Ferreira Conference didn't occur. Now, that is true, although it was scheduled three times. The first time it was scheduled because there was no affidavit whatsoever. And the plaintiff was reminded both by the court and defense counsel through correspondence and submissions that an affidavit of merit was required and specific citation to the statute was made so that it was certainly possible for the plaintiff to refer to that. But secondly, we know that plaintiff was aware of her obligations because she submitted not one, not two, but three documents in response to the motion practice. So our position, I was just going to say that our position is that yes, no Ferreira Conference took place, but all of the purposes for the Ferreira Conference were satisfied by the motion practice that occurred, the exchange of documents, and finally, by the oral argument on the motion, which still occurred before the 120th day. So as the court in Ferreira and other cases following Ferreira pointed out, the purpose of the Ferreira Conference is to, number one, let the plaintiff remind the plaintiff, should already know, that an affidavit is required, and number two, to flesh out any deficiencies. Well, every time the plaintiff submitted a new document, we pointed out the deficiencies.
So in this case, and judges do their best, in this case, the judge said the Ferreira Conference is not designed to say you need to file an affidavit of merit. It's designed to go over between the plaintiff and defendant the sufficiency that was provided. Is the judge's statement a correct statement of law?
Well, Your Honor, I I don't know. I think it's a little confusing, but I think for purposes of deciding this.
Here's what Ferreira says. If no affidavit has been served, the court will remind the parties of their obligations under the statute and case law. And in AC, the judiciary failed to do what this court expected, namely to act as a backdrop. No one's faulting you for this, but there was no Ferreira conference. And the reason there was no Ferreira conference appears to be contrary to what this court has already said on multiple occasions, correct?
I can't dispute that, Your Honor.
So what should happen? What's the remedy, if any, when there's no Ferreira conference?
Well, all the cases say that we're gonna find some exceptional circumstances in this particular case, but we're not gonna do it anymore going forward. And unfortunately, that never happens. I refer to Justice Rivera Soto's apt concurring opinion in the Paragon case, that it seems that every time there is an issue in this regard, even though the litigants, and this includes pro se litigants as much as represented ones, even though they fail to conform to the pretty simple, ultimately, and clear dictates of the statute, somehow the every time there's a failure, the finger gets pointed somewhere else, on the court, on the opposing counsel.
So the dictates of holding a Ferreira conference are equally clear at this point. Is it appropriate to consider, how is it appropriate to factor the absence of a Ferreira conference in?
Well, Your Honor, none of the cases that are cited, neither Ferreira nor the ones that came after it, including Paragon, none of them say that if there is no Ferreira conference, then the affidavit of merit goes out the window.
That's now, true. Is it appropriate to consider the absence of a Ferreira conference as part of the analysis under exceptional circumstances?
I think it can be considered, but if that's really the only substantive problem, especially in a case like this, where the facts are such that the purposes of having the Ferreira conference were in fact satisfied by the motion practice that occurred. When you have that kind of situation, I don't think that all of those factors add up to exceptional circumstances.
But related to that, can you tell us how your client is harmed under the circumstances of this case, with all the notice and all the conversations and motions and discussion that had taken place through four failed affidavits of merit?
So I would quote from the concurring opinion of Justice Rivera Soto in the Paragon case. It is deeply troubling that as a result of the relief ordered today, third-party defendant Key Engineers, Inc. effectively will be denied the specific right granted to it by law, its statutory entitlement to either the receipt of a timely and proper affidavit of merit or the dismissal of claims against it. So
was your client sufficiently on notice?
I'm sorry?
Was your client sufficiently on notice by what transpired in this case?
We were on notice that there's a suit, Your Honor, here's the troubling part.
Sorry, weren't you also on notice in the affidavit of merit that there was a specific allegation that it was Dr. Singh who acted negligently, and he is an employee of your client, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, but I would take issue with a number of things that have been said concerning Dr. Singh. First of all, there's nothing in the record below indicating what his specialty area is. That's number one.
There is something
available. Correct.
Well, I dispute that as well. So, as I indicated in my brief, the document that the plaintiff relies on specifically has a caveat in it that says that this is not to be relied on for any of those purposes, not by anyone
specialty
other than patients. Counsel, it's not a reliable source. And that says it right in the source document.
What is Dr. Singh's specialty?
Well, I do not know, because I looked at the same website that counsel did.
Sorry,
and there
he's
are
an employee
five
of your client.
I'm correct. Sorry?
He is an employee of your client, correct?
Not any longer.
Okay. Notwithstanding
at the time and hasn't been since before the suit was filed.
Notwithstanding what Dr. Singh's specialty is, can we go back to the question that just the Chief Justice asked? How has your client been prejudiced? The complaint was fairly detailed, explaining the circumstances and the basis for the claim. Several affidavits of merit were submitted explaining the basis for the claim and what has been what's been alleged. How is it that your client has been prejudiced here?
So I disagree with all of that. So the our so client
the complaint,
has been
so the complaint did not give the hospital did not put the hospital on notice of the decedent at issue.
If the
date of the incident or anything, is that what you're stating?
No. What the defendant is entitled to, and what every case from Kornblatt on discussing this issue says, is that the defendant is entitled to early notice that there is actual merit to the case. The defendant maintains
That's not what any of them say. They say there's a reasonable basis to proceed.
I will find the citation if I may.
And before you head down that road, isn't that exactly why you have to have a Ferreira conference to discuss exactly these things? So the court can decide if these things that you're saying that have never been fleshed out in court have any merit at all.
Well, actually, all of these things were
fleshed. What are his qualifications?
All of these things were fleshed out at the motion hearing. And if I may, as I said earlier, the conference was scheduled three times. After the first time,
what was said at the motion hearing, as the reason there was no Ferrara conference needed, required, or that we should suggest it should have been had here to effectuate the purpose, that Ferreira says the conference should be had. That's what you're going to rely on. At the motion hearing, the motion to dismiss, the motion that knocked her out of court, prevented her from amending her complaint, prevented her from naming Dr. Singh, who you knew from the very beginning because your client provided the medical records that named him, that motion is what substitutes for the Ferreira conference when the plaintiff, pro se, is told you need more, or maybe you don't need more. We don't know because the conference never took place. That's what you're relying on?
Well, motion? The plaintiff was told at the motion that she needed more.
The motion here.
Well, for that part of it, Your Honor, if the issue is that if this court is now going to have a new decision that says anytime there is no Ferreira conference, then the affidavit of merit is...
This court will decide the decision and the breadth of it, not you. So before you suggest what we're going to do, why don't you answer my question? You were lying on that motion hearing when the complaint was dismissed with prejudice to say that satisfies what was required under Ferreira.
Under the facts of this case, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
So
Ferreira conference would have likely come out what specialty Dr. Singh had?
It's possible.
Wouldn't the judge or counsel or pro se plaintiff have said, I want to know so that I can comply with my obligation under the affidavit of merit statute?
It's possible. But if I may go back to my very beginning. The problem with this case has less to do with whether Dr. Fallon was qualified, whether there was a matchup. I mean, I've pointed out those problems in part to respond to plaintiff's argument and to questions here. But as I said in the beginning, there's two pages of a voluminous medical record here. The claim here is not, if this was a claim where the plaintiff claimed that during the course of a surgical procedure, a complication occurred, the ureter was clipped. All you would need, arguably, is that surgical operative report.
Sorry, but here plaintiff does state that Dr. Fallon did review those two pages. He just did not write in the affidavit of merit, and I reviewed these two pages, correct?
For purposes of this argument, I will concede that.
Great. So then if that is the case, then where in the affidavit of merit statute does it say, and the affidavit of merit must state that the exactly what the doctor reviewed, or that the doctor reviewed the two pages of medical records that the defendant submitted?
It doesn't say that, nor does it say that the defendant has to identify in their answer their specialty qualifications. It says nowhere that there should be a Ferreira conference.
I understand that we have imposed additional, that this court has imposed additional obligations on defendants. However, this court has also said that it refuses to, quote, add requirements not explicitly set forth that deny plaintiffs their day in court. So where have we ever added additional requirements on a plaintiff to the AOM statute and said, even though the statute does not require this plaintiff, you will now not be entitled to your day in court unless you comply with these additional requirements that we are placing on you?
I can't cite to a case, but as I understand it, if an affidavit of merit is challenged, the plaintiff is required to demonstrate the qualifications.
Subspecialty is not in the statute. That's a case law addition, is it not?
No, it's that's the section 41. The statute says that there must be like to like. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
If the statute refers to an appropriately licensed person, correct? And then it also says the person must have particular expertise in the specific specialty. That's what the statute says. We
yes,
didn't add that.
It, right. Okay. But what was added was proving it. Just like it doesn't say in the statute that
added that the defendant had to provide that information so that the plaintiff would be able to have the matchup. Where have we ever added a requirement on the plaintiff and said, even though the statute spells out these requirements, we are now adding another one?
So am I to understand then that the plaintiff is not required to provide a CV or any qualifications from their expert when they serve the affidavit?
The statute says that the person has to be an appropriate licensed person. So you could say that in order to show that the person is appropriately licensed, they would have to show that they're licensed and what appropriate means. But the statute does say that. That the person writing the affidavit of merit, it says, provide each defendant with an affidavit of an appropriate licensed person. So it does say that you can't just have a person on the street write it up and submit it.
Yes, but if the plaintiff says that my expert is an appropriately licensed person, or it says in the affidavit, I am an appropriately licensed person to opine on this case, and it is my opinion that there's a reasonable likelihood that the care treatment that was provided fell short of acceptable standards, that's all we get. Because that's all this statute says.
No, the statute also talks about having particular expertise in the general area or the specialty involved in the action as evidenced by board certification or by devotion of the person's practice substantially to the general area or specialty involved in the action for a period of at least 5 years. So the statute is very particular. Where have we imposed additional requirements beyond those found in the statute on a plaintiff?
And I'm saying that the courts have universally required plaintiffs to demonstrate that those facts are the case. And that's what we're asking for here
If you had a basis to challenge the expert, that might be necessary. In this case, where do you have any basis to challenge what the expert relied on, knowing that you provided the two pages that talked about the code blue and talked about everything that occurred that night?
So that's a two-part question. So first part of it is, I only make that argument as support for our argument that the plaintiff should be required on being challenged to show that there was a factual basis for the affiant to make the claim. That's number one. Number two, it's true that we supplied two pages of the record, but it's not the complete record even of the code. That code, there's a code sheet that occurs. This is a code progress note that's written after the fact. The important piece of information in every code that's run in every hospital, there are multiple people involved in the code. One of those individuals is charged with making a contemporaneous record of everything that happens, including every medication administered.
You never provided that to plaintiff, right?
Correct. It was never requested.
So you're saying that the affidavit of merit was insufficient because the person didn't review a document that you never provided?
Because it was never requested. Correct. I mean, we haven't yet adopted the federal practice, which requires automatic discovery and production of documents without demand. That hasn't occurred yet in New Jersey practice. And going forward, maybe that will happen. But there was no the Section 28 clearly says that and the case law decided under it. In order to get to serve an affidavit in lieu of an affidavit of merit, there has to be shown that a proper request has been made. And that was never argued before. I also hasten to add out a lot of things have been injected into this record, not only at the appellate division after the trial court, but into this court even after the petition for certification was granted. So
but are you challenging the Dr. Fallon's AOM and his basis on the two pages that he did review?
So this is a particular type of case. As I started to say earlier, before I got a little bit sidetracked, if this were a case alleging that a defendant affirmatively did something negligent to the patient, all you would need is that basic factual information. What happened, what the allegation is here, and that's one thing that's clear and we can't ignore. Well, let me just say that what's the allegation here is what is clear about it is that it's a claim of omission. Now, how can in good faith, how can any affiant say that there was reasonable likelihood to believe that something didn't happen if they don't have all of the information, including information that might say just and clearly in black and white in five different places that action actually did happen?
Are you alleging that that is what the case in this record?
All that is missing from the record. And we know that if a patient is in the hospital for 3 days,
no, but your undergoes client has the medical records. It's not missing from you.
Well, it's missing from me personally, but it's nowhere in the record.
How can you make that argument? How can you make that argument if you don't know the answer?
Because the argument is that plaintiff has an obligation here to obtain an affidavit of merit, I'm sorry,
which she did.
Well, it has to be an affidavit of merit that is based on something. So I was asked about prejudice before, and I got a little bit sidetracked on that. The prejudice to the client here is that we could go through two or more years of discovery only to find out after all of that happens that in fact there was glucose lab testing performed. The lab tests came back the way they did. The nursing notes indicates that they carried out the physician's orders. The physician's orders are all proper.
Why would you have to go through discovery? I'm still confused about this. That's knowledge in your client's possession. So why would you have to go through 2 years of discovery to find that out? Your client should know that from day one. They can just go back
and we contend that all that happened, but because of the status of the case, the motion came about because the plaintiff didn't bother to find any of that out. They didn't bother the plaintiff did not bother to ascertain that there actually was a meritorious case based on what actually happened in the case.
I'm not asking what really happened, but is it the hospital's contention that there was glucose testing in this case?
Yes. And in fact, that's even indicated in the two pages that we have. If I may refer to those exhibits.
It's the two pages provided to the plaintiff?
Yes, these are the ones that are in the record that the plaintiff received and that the plaintiff is using to support the claim that she provided it to Dr. Fallon. And that therefore, you know, that's what he based it on. What we have here is, first of all,
Give us a citation to that.
So this would be on the confidential appendix CR4 and CR5. And on those two pages, there is indication that the
have a sense we're looking at the same document because of how hard it is to read.
It is. Well, let me go back to what I found easily. The patient here refused lab testing multiple times during the course of the day. That can't be laid at the foot of the physicians.
Is this something that really would get resolved at the affidavit of merit stage? Aren't these defenses that would be appropriately presented at the time of trial?
So I guess what the argument is that the if there was a dispute about it, yes. But here there's just an ignoring of the facts.
This is or a summary judgment motion could be made about this.
And again, that would not be effective until after all expert reports had been served and usually after expert discovery. So again, a couple of years down the road. If you look at the three documents that the plaintiff submitted in support of her contention that there was substantial compliance, first of all, aside from their other multiple deficiencies, what they all say is that there's a requirement of blood glucose testing within 1 to 2 hours after the patient becomes unresponsive. If you look at, again, CR4, the entire code lasted just minutes over an hour. So again, on its face, contrary to what plaintiff's experts seem to be saying in general terms, the standard of care was complied with. So
we're not here litigating the merits.
I
we're here discussing the affidavit of merit statute, the requirements of the affidavit of merit, things that aren't what you're arguing is germane to the case, but not necessarily germane to the issue before the court.
All I'm trying to establish, Your Honor, is that there needs to be an actual controversy in order to justify going through all of the judicial research.
But there is a controversy. So you're stating it sounds like you're stating on the merits there didn't really need to be testing because it was just over an hour that the code blue lasted. Their allegation is that she was admitted as a known type 1 diabetic for ketoacidosis, and during the entire hour of the code blue, there was no glucose testing, and an assumption was made that it was drug related, which is why Narcan was administered. That's what the allegation is. And for affidavit of merit purposes, all that needs to be shown is that there exists a reasonable probability that the care, skill, and knowledge exercise fell outside the acceptable professional or occupational standards.
And yes?
Do you agree that that's what their allegation is?
Which yes.
Is contrary to what you are arguing, which is the merits.
Well, that's the allegation of the pro se plaintiff who's not a physician. So we have a pro se plaintiff who is making arguments based on medicine that she is not competent to do.
And then she received and then she obtained an affidavit of merit from a physician.
From a physician who did not review the materials that every physician.
So in every case, are the courts to get into the weeds of exactly how many pieces of paper a physician or affiant on the affidavit of merit has reviewed?
It's not because that
you conceded from the beginning of your argument that yes, although Dr. Fallon didn't state that he reviewed the medical records, he did have those records, the two pages that plaintiff obtained. But now your argument is that doesn't matter. He didn't review enough.
Under the particular facts of this case, that's correct. I think there has to be a determination. In other words, an expert gets the admitting note and says that a patient was admitted for a diagnosis X, is in the hospital for 7 or 8 days, and then the patient expires because it turns out that through the course of working the patient up, the patient had a completely different disease, but the based on the admitting note, which is the only thing the expert has seen, the expert says, well, there's a reasonable probability that they misdiagnosed the patient without seeing that over the course of the hospitalization, the correct diagnosis, the patient was correctly worked up and correctly diagnosed. So now we have to go through 2+ years of litigation, discovery, and expert review, and expert reports and depositions in order to establish that the case never had merit from day one.
Counsel,
that's what the statute was designed.
I think we have your position. Is there anything you'd like to add to close out your argument?
Briefly, let me just check my note for 1 minute. Okay, so just the one point that we haven't touched on in my discussion, and I'll try and hit it very quickly. In the Fink case, the Fink case itself says that in a case involving an affidavit of merit, the statute requires that the plaintiff provide an affidavit detailing a reasonable probability that at least one claim concerning each defendant has merit. So what was pointed out both in the trial court and in the appellate division is that the expert in this case did not say and could have said, if it were true and he could verify it, that every person who treated, every professional who treated this plaintiff deviated from accepted standards of care, that could be a sufficient affidavit.
No, but he did say that at least one of the John and Jane Doe defendants sued therein, now known to be Dr. Vika Singh, the physician in charge of the efforts to resuscitate decedent, fell below the standard. And that person was the employee of the hospital, correct?
Yes, but what he's saying is it could have been Dr. Singh, or it could have been another physician with a specialty that I don't have.
The only person that he mentions by name, he says defendant Michael P. Carson and at least one of the John or Jane Doe defendants sued therein, now known to be Dr. Vika Singh. The only person mentioned by name, Dr. Vika Singh, because Dr. Carson at that point, the hospital had said wasn't involved. So he's not throwing out 600 different names that the hospital has to go find. One person employed by the hospital.
Okay, so two things about that. Number one, I just want to back off of something that was implied earlier, and that is that the argument was made by plaintiff that we were saying that every single defendant had to be identified by name, and I that's not what we're saying. But they have to be identified at least in terms of what care they provided to the patient, and what their, if they're a physician, what their medical specialty is, because otherwise you cannot
identified. It says the physician in charge of the efforts to resuscitate decedent. So it says exactly what he did.
And even Dr. Carson, who's mentioned in
what
the
he doesn't say, he, so
even,
I guess,
even Dr. Carson, who's mentioned in the affidavit, is listed as the on-call physician, the attending physician in the 2 pages of notes.
That's correct, but he was never present for the code.
But he received calls during the code.
No, not during the code, during the course of the day. It's very clear he did not receive any call during the code.
Which is why the AOM specifically mentions Dr. Singh, the physician in charge of the efforts to resuscitate decedent. How could that possibly not give you notice as to which employee of the hospital they're talking about?
Because he says it's either Dr. Singh or any one of the other individuals who were involved in the code or other people as well.
You say this person was negligent and other people might have been also. That's not enough?
That's not what he says. He doesn't say Dr. Singh definitely was or even was and maybe others. What he says is one of this list, and the list includes Dr. Singh, one of those. So we've got Dr. Singh, Dr. Carson, I'll say Dr. A, B, C, D, and E.
He didn't mention those though, right?
Yes, he does. He specifically mentions those.
No, he never says Dr. A, B, C, or D.
No, he says John Doe's. So he tracks the complaint. He says all the John Doe's.
But he says including.
Yeah, including the John Doe's.
So it's the problem is that he wrote including Dr. Singh. No, I'm sorry. But I'm reading
says,
this again.
He says, including Dr. Singh, one of the John Doe's.
So what's the problem with that?
So when he says
Dr. Singh was negligent and he was one of the John Doe's.
He's not saying Dr. Singh was negligent. He's saying Dr. Singh might have been. That's not reasonable likelihood.
There exists a reasonable probability that the care, skill, or knowledge exercised or exhibited by one or more of the defendants therein, parentheses, including Dr. Singh, comma, one of the John and J. Doe defendants sued therein, in close parentheses, in the treatment, fell outside the acceptable standards of practice. Where in those words is he saying, actually, lots of people were negligent and I can't possibly know who?
I guess we just read that sentence differently. What that sentence means to me is that one of the people that he's listing, and he's lists Singh, John Doe's, and Dr. Carson, one or maybe more of them.
He doesn't list Dr. Carson in that paragraph, and he doesn't list, as the chief pointed out, he only says that Dr. Singh is one of the John or Jane Doe defendants. He doesn't say specifically that other John or Jane Doe defendants could have been negligent. Paragraph 4.
We'll let you have the last word, but I assure you we have the argument that you've raised with respect
to that. I don't want to debate the language. I think I've said what it is. You're going to have to keep reading it. I interpret it differently. That's all I can say about that.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Flynn.
Your Honors, there's been significant and substantial discussion on the merits of the case by both the petitioner and respondent. Suffice it to say that whatever the court's decision is here with respect to the Ferreira conference being required and resolving this matter, I think it best for me just to focus on some of the principles that apply with respect to why the Affidavit of Merit statute was enacted to begin with, and the circumstances as they affect physicians and the provision of patient care. Plaintiff has requested certain relief that hasn't yet been addressed. So I would just like to go through some comments on the physician's perspective here and why that statute is important to physicians and the public at large and the patient population that they provide care to. The Affidavit of Merit statute was enacted to insulate healthcare providers from being subject to meritless liability claims that distract from the provision of care to those in need of same. An erosion of the intent and mandates of the act will harm the very patients the legislation seeks to protect. And I can explain how. Physicians' time and resources necessary to defend against meritless litigation as defined by the act will increase precipitously as further exceptions to the statute are found. Now, counsel for petitioner made a comment that the medical society would have you believe there should be no exceptions. That's not our argument here. What we believe is Ferreira provides this court with the basis to deal with the issues in this particular matter. But when making a decision on what should be done, please keep in mind the physician's perspective. Now, plaintiff had requested in a very brief paragraph at the very end of her motion or opposition to our motion for leave to appear, that this court developed two equitable doctrines. One, the trial court's failure to hold a timely Ferrara conference tolls a pro se plaintiff's time for filing of an affidavit of merit. And number two, a plaintiff, particularly a pro se plaintiff, may seek relief from the affidavit of merit requirement when the defendants act in a confusing manner as to the affidavit of merit requirement. Those are the exceptions or extraordinary circumstances that we do take exception to. We think there's enough here for the court. If the court were to decide the Ferrara conference not held requires the case being sent back, it should end there. There are issues.
You're suggesting that we shouldn't adopt a lawyer confusion standard?
Probably not, Your Justice. That would, yes, wreak havoc throughout the system, I would assume. Physicians are prejudiced by the continued finding of exceptions to the affidavit of merit, and that's what this would do. A tolling for pro se plaintiffs or focusing on pro se plaintiffs.
Is that just to make clear, your view is that the extraordinary circumstances standard, you're not here to say it should be abolished.
Oh, no, no, that's not our position. That's not an argument that we've made. And I'm quite frankly not sure where that came from. But in this particular case, we did make the argument, as already covered by petitioner and respondent, that it's been satisfied. My focus right now is that to go further than is necessary, and by going further, meaning tolling a pro se plaintiff's time for filing of an affidavit of merit, or allowing a pro se plaintiff to seek relief of the affidavit of merit requirement when the defendants act in a confusing manner that's so ambiguous.
Yeah, Ms. Flynn, if I could help, we understand your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. You want to, yeah. Ms. Vassilou Harvey, did you want to offer rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Sorry. Defendant had indicated an incorrect statement of the law that we don't follow the federal standard for requiring the record to be supplied. But here's what we do require. Under our uniform interrogatories, 4:17-1B2, a party defendant served with a complaint in an action subject to uniform interrogatories, as this one is, shall be deemed to have been simultaneously served with such interrogatories. Defendant shall serve answers to the appropriate uniform interrogatories within 60 days after service by that defendant of the answer to the complaint. So here, within 60 days, before the 120 would have run, Mrs. Michella was entitled to the entire record, not just two pages. So for counsel to stand up here and say, well, she should have had all of that, that goes to my argument as to this confusion of counsel.
Remind me, counsel, is the attachment of the medical record part of the interrogatories,
yes,
or is that a document?
No, it's in the interrogatories, correct. It's number 7, attach a complete of C3, attach a complete copy of any written records or documents that you have regarding plaintiff. So it was required. Mrs. Michelle was pro se and didn't understand that. So when the trial court said, well, you didn't make your request in time, that also was an incorrect statement by the trial court. The issue that as in terms of what I was really asking for as to this confusion standard is that here, that record that was attached that she did have said Dr. Carson was the attending, that he was supervising the care. And what I'm really drawing in the Yagnik decision
on at 467 NJ Super 91, Appellate Division 2021. And what I'm asking this court is to really flesh out for exceptional circumstances that when the defendant's conduct adds to that confusion, that then plaintiff doesn't understand to comply. Because here the record is clear from the oral argument that plaintiff didn't understand, can I just submit the affidavit without the Ferrara conference? And what do I do when Carson was an attending and
yet he's dismissed? You would agree that obviously some cases are brought by pro se plaintiffs. A defendant does not and should not be put in any situation of trying to advise the plaintiff on how to proceed.
Correct.
Obviously that's a complete conflict of interest. Correct. And it's relationship with the court. So in terms of you're not suggesting there was some duty to unravel for the plaintiff what this is all about.
No, I'm saying factually, when the conduct led to the confusion and the failure to comply with the statute, if you find that she didn't comply, then that forms a basis for exceptional circumstances as set forth in YACNA. That's what I'm asking this court to do.
Perhaps more complicated if you phrase it that way, because I understood counsel to be arguing confusion is hardly a rigorous standard that people can objectively interpret. If you've got misconduct by the other side, you can raise that as a point. But the relief that was articulated may not be quite that precise. Is
correct. But also under the exceptional circumstances, it's not precise. It's a totality of the circumstances case. And so what I'm saying is that in this case, that how this all unfolded, particularly during a global pandemic, that it created exceptional circumstances.
And to be clear, I'm not suggesting there was misconduct in this case.
Correct. And that's why I'm saying that you don't have to reach the misconduct, because the effect of which was confusion upon Mrs. Michella.
Well, there's no allegation of misconduct, just to be clear.
Correct. It's just the manner in which it created confusion of attaching something that said he's the attending, but then saying he's not involved led to the circumstances that she didn't understand to include Dr. Carson in that affidavit of merit. So I think the court has my argument set. And I would just point out that much of what Mr. Malta had argued could have been resolved in the Ferrara conference, including that problematic language that he has that I think it's clear as day that Dr. Singh was included. But to the extent that there is just a confusion in how it's framed, then that's the point of the 4-hour conference. And in this case, it worked an injustice to not have.
Thank you,
Your Honors.